Good morning, everyone. We just heard a very lovely rendition of the song, the title of which is the subject of the talk today, which is the second half of what we began last month. This Dub 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 Rup Shagare Amar Mon, Dive Deep, O Mind. This was a song that Sri Ramakrishna was very, very fond of. We find it mentioned, I think, 8 times in the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna, and he must have heard it many other times in addition to that and sang it himself. So it was something that captured his imagination because the ideas in it are so similar to his spiritual outlook, this idea of not floating on the surface but diving deep in spiritual life. The first line says, "Dive deep, O mind, dive deep in the ocean of God's beauty. If you descend to the uttermost depths there, you will find the gem of love." This is a song that was written by someone named Kubir, who was part of this Baul community. The Baals were a very interesting group because they didn't fit very easily into any one particular category. There were Vaishnavas who were Baals, there were Shaktas, there were Sufis who were Baals, and sometimes they were all mixed up together. There's a very nice film called Mone Manush about this Lalwan Fakir. If you see that, you'll get some idea how they didn't make any distinction about community or caste or religion or anything. They all had this very free type of ecstatic longing for realization. So it was kind of a mystical and esoteric tradition, and we find that in the lyrics to this song, of course. And this particular movement, we can see just by the language of it, Vrindavan and everything, that it more or less fits within this Vaishnava tradition. And yet, the Baals of this particular group, and this was this the Vaishnav Charan and some of the Ghoshpada and Koltabhaja, some of the groups that Thakur knew at that time, they didn't care so much for these gods and goddesses. It was more this Nalalila, God dwelling within, and worship of the Guru. So there was a lot of this Guru Bhakti there. But we see this seeking Vrindavan within the heart, in the depths of the heart. So it was an esoteric, mystical type of tradition. And so we can see how Sri Ramakrishna would have been obviously very much attracted to this. And he would always go into some ecstatic mood when he would hear these types of songs. Last time we met, I tried to explain, give my understanding of this idea of diving deep. And we looked at it from 3 different points of view. The other one is taking the plunge, that initial resolve, that do or die attitude. We don't know exactly where it will lead us. We're maybe going without a safety net, but we're willing to take the plunge. We don't care. And we're not willing to just float on the surface, and we're not going to go in. You know how old people go into the water? Of course, me, no. You go in little by little. You get your ankles wet, and then you get your hands wet, and you sprinkle water, so you get used to it. And little kids, they'll dive right in, just like that. They won't think about anything else. So this is that first idea, that no calculating about what it will feel like, whether the water will be too cold, whether we'll want to get out quickly or not, but having some faith, some conviction, and just being willing to take the plunge. So this is that first idea. Then, second idea was that we're trying to immerse ourselves, immerse the mind in spiritual thought. And this is where the devotion of the heart comes in, that we want to be fully immersed, like a fish fully immersed in water. That we want to go deep enough and down that we forget anything above the surface of the water. We enter into our own spiritual realm where we're so engrossed with this spiritual ideal that we forget everything else. We see it even with, let's say, a great scientist or a great athlete. They get zoned in. To such an extent, they forget everything else. So we have this idea of this all-embracing, all-encompassing longing of the heart and grabbing of the mind, so that we enter into an entirely different world. We dive deep into this ocean. So this is the second thing that the real spiritual seeker has to have to remain fully immersed, to remain on this spiritual journey, to be so devoted to the spiritual ideal that everything else becomes secondary. Not that we ignore it or we don't fulfill our duties or anything, but this becomes the number one thing. Now, the third idea is, of course, similar to this, is not so much immersing the mind in this ideal, but going beneath the surface of the mind itself. And this is what we try to do in meditation, to go deep beneath the surface level of the mind. So we enter into some intuitive level of feeling and love and devotion. This meditation, we, of course, have to use this faculty of mind to try to curb the mind. But ultimately, we have to reach some level which is beyond mind. And it becomes more a question of feeling. It becomes more a question of the heart, really, than the mind. If we can really get established in some meditative mood, then we understand that better to think of it in terms of a mood than think of it in terms of mind control. If we think of meditation as mind control, then we're still kind of floating on the surface. If we can immerse it in that ideal with a little devotion, then we can get to this third type of diving deep. So we have these three different ideas. We take the plunge, then we want to have the saturation effect. The spiritual life becomes the most important thing for us. Then we want to be able to really withdraw the mind from the world, withdraw the mind from even thought level, and go deep to that area where we can feel merged, we can feel one with that divine presence within the heart. So that was kind of the background. Today, I would like to focus more on the practical aspects of this topic. How do we do it? It sounds very nice, but how do we do it, and how do we develop that mindset that allows us to do it? How do we free ourselves from a lot of our worldly attachments and things which prevent us from diving deep? One thing we have to do is try to find out what the obstacles are, because unless we know what the obstacles are, then it's very difficult to transcend them. So we have to clearly see what it is that's holding us to the world. And if we analyze, generally we find that there are three different aspects that we can pinpoint. And one we can say is this: the world itself. What are the external circumstances we find ourselves in? What are the entanglements? What are the duties, responsibilities, our job, our family, whatever duties we have, social standing, whatever, all of these things, interpersonal relationships, all of these things. These are what cause us to have attachments, which cause us to have the mind get upset, to have pride and anger, all of the things that we're aware of. So we have the world itself. Then we have the physical body, that we sit for meditation and the aches and pains come. And we have to face this prospect of disease and old age and death, all of these things. So all of these things work on the mind. And then the third one, of course, is the mind itself. And if we really want to analyze, we can just forget about the first two, and because everything is the mind. There may be some external circumstances, there may be some physical circumstances, but ultimately the real obstacles will be all of these different attachments that we have, these desires that we have, these false ideas that we have, the pride, anger, all of the things that keep us bound to this body idea and that keep us from really being able to dive deep. These are the things that keep us. It's like we're trying to dive deep, but we're wearing a life vest. It keeps pulling us back to the surface, all of these things. So we have to be able to deal with all of these things, and then we can start looking at the positive aspect. And really, we're not going to get a new list of things to do today. It'll be the same old list, but the intensity aspect will be a little bit different. The further we go towards the depths, the more some of these things will change a little bit for us. And we'll see that there's an intensity aspect which will actually change the value itself. It'll change the way we approach things, the way we do things, the effects that they have. So we'll see holy company, solitude, prayer, worship, pilgrimage, all of these things. All of the things which we start with in spiritual life, as we go and continue doing them, we have to notch them up to a different level. And the intensity has to become greater and greater. So we have these practices, then we have to cultivate discrimination, detachment, longing for God, realization. And then we have all of our spiritual practices associated with the different yogas also. So as I say, each one will have a kind of a specific type of application based on the level of intensity that we have. So the type of meditation that we do, so there's a way of practicing yoga, a way of practicing meditation that we do for 5 minutes and we do it so we can function better at work. All right. Then there's a type of meditation we do that we want to at least go a little bit inward that way. But there's a type of meditation that we do with this tremendous longing of heart. So we'll see, each one of these will have a slightly different type of application. Now, this is a very important thing for us to think about. To what extent do we really want to dive deep? To what extent do we want to, as opposed to sitting on the edge of the cup and leaning over and drinking the syrup inside? Even Swamiji was hesitant to dive right into it. Right? So we have to find our level in all of this, and we have to understand that when we shouldn't pray, Mother, make me mad with thy love, unless we're really willing to go mad. And some people go mad. So this all of this needs a big dose of common sense, all of this. And so some of these things won't be appropriate for any of us in the fullest extent. We'll read about and hear about the types of spiritual practices that were done by the direct disciples in Bharanagarmat. We know we can't do it, but we can catch something from it. We can learn something from it. Sri Ramakrishna, he understood this very well. He used to speak about different receptacles, different sizes, adhar. Some were large, that they could withstand a lot of spiritual emotions and everything, and others not so much. So he would very often talk about it in that sense. But we see so much of this emphasis on not pulling any punches. And we see so much emphasis on really doing it 100%. Now, why? This is a very legitimate question. Why should we, if we're not in a stage of life, if we're not in a situation where we can do this, why does he talk about it so much? Why should we even discuss it so much? One thing is that really this was more or less the most important teaching that he gave. He came to the world for this. He didn't come to the world to pull punches. He came to give punches. He came to really give us 100% so that we can do as much of it as we can. Swamiji, he used to make that point. He would say, let people know the full ideal. And if they do as much of it as they can, but don't lower the ideal. So we're going to get the full ideal today. And as much as it of it as we can use, we'll use that way. And the things that we realize don't apply to us, then we'll simply say, well, these are for the handful of great souls in this world. These are not for everyone. But what we have to do is catch a little drop, just get a glimpse of that tremendous longing for God realization that Thakur had and that the others had and that he wanted us to have, just a little bit. So that we can go as deep as is possible for us and gradually go deeper and deeper. This is the thing. So, as I say, Sri Ramakrishna understood this idea that not everyone was ready for that. There's a nice incident in the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna. Sri Ramakrishna was speaking to the devotees, and he said, one day Keshav was delivering a lecture. He said, O Lord, grant us that we may dive into the river of divine love and go straight to the ocean of Satchidananda. Now, generally, Keshav wouldn't talk like that. Because Thakur was there, he got a little bit inspired. The ladies were seated behind the screen. In those days, they would separate. So all the women would be on one side and the men on the other side. I said to Keshav, how can you dive once for all? Pointing to the ladies, I said, then what would happen to them? Every now and then, you must return to dry land. You must dive and rise alternately. And he says, Keshav and the others laughed. They laughed, but it's actually a serious thing. We have to make sure that we don't neglect our duties in the world, and we have to make sure that we don't really go mad, because it does happen sometimes. I'll give one example of this type of spiritual madness. Of course, spiritual madness isn't bad, but we don't want the other kind. Now, we think with Swami Vivekananda, he'll be the biggest possible receptacle that we can imagine, right, except for Thakur. It'll be this huge receptacle. And you remember the incident in Kashipur. Sri Ramakrishna had given Swamiji this mantra that he himself had received from the Jatadhari when he was worshipping the baby Rama. And Swamiji was repeating this, and he just went mad and was running around and repeating it and everything, and they were all worried, the other his brother disciples and everything. So they went to Sri Ramakrishna, and they said, oh, what happened to Naren? He's running around like a madman. He can't contain himself. He's filled with such joy and everything. So Thakur said, good, let him stay like that for some time. He always wanted these types of experiences. This is similar to his Nirvikalpa Samadhi also. And then he said, you see, I passed 12 long years in the state, he said to Narendra, in the state you are experiencing for one night. So if there's such a difference in this size of the receptacle between Swamiji and Sri Ramakrishna, imagine between us and Swamiji himself. All right. So this is just a little warning with all of this. We shouldn't think that we can, dive straight down and without even any extra oxygen or anything and get to the gems at the bottom. So we all have different capacities. We have to build up our lung power little by little. That's the thing. Then we'll dive a little, then we'll come back up, and we'll increase our capacity. If we try to dive too fast, then it won't work. We'll get this, what are they called, bends, huh? Some type of reaction like that. So these are things to be done gradually. But to try to increase in spiritual life, this idea of increasing intensity is very important. I mentioned once before, years ago, I believe, this first time when I went to Tribhuco, and the first question they asked me was, do I know plumbing? So I knew a little bit, but not much. Anyhow, I became the assistant plumber there. So there's a little tool that they use to cut pipe, this lead pipe. And it's a tiny little tool. It's a clamp that you tighten, and it has a little cutting edge on it. I don't know if they still do. It's very old-fashioned type of stuff. And you spin it around once, and it cuts a little groove, and you tighten it again, spin it around, it cuts a groove. You keep tightening it as you go. If it's too tight in the beginning, you can't even turn it. So we try to gear up the intensity too much in the beginning, nothing will work. But if we keep turning without tightening it, the groove won't get deeper and deeper, and we won't cut through the pipe. So in spiritual life, we have to gradually increase the intensity little by little. And this, with this tiny little tool that we have, this little mind that we have, we can cut through this great big thick lead pipe that way. It's a tremendous thing. So how do we learn to dive deep? First thing is, we have to have some understanding of what it means to lead a spiritual life. We talk about spiritual life nowadays. They have all of these polls that all of these people say, not religious, but spiritual. What does it mean to be spiritual? If we want to lead a spiritual life, we have to do spiritual practice. This is the sad truth of the whole thing. If we don't do anything, we say, well, yes, I'm a spiritual person. But we don't do anything. We have to have something, some prayer, some meditation, some worship, some regular type of routine. We have to have something. So if we want to talk about spiritual life, we have to talk about spiritual practice. So we have different types. Some will be routine. These are the things that we do every day. And having a fixed time for everything and sticking to this routine is something very, very important. As Swami Swamiji always used to say, bind yourself to a routine. It's a very wonderful thing. If we don't do that, then everything will be haphazard. We may get up early one day, we may get up late one day, we may skip it one day. If we can have a fixed routine and bind ourselves to that, then this is the very first step in spiritual life. We don't have to be too inflexible because things come up, but as far as possible, to try to bind ourselves that way. So this is one thing. These are the types of practices that will have their own little time slot. Then there are other things we try to do throughout the day that are not so much fixed. So we try to practice this constant remembrance. We try to keep an undercurrent of meditation going. We try to practice offering the fruits of action or karma yoga. If possible, we can try to practice silent repetition of the mantra throughout the day as far as possible. And just keeping the spiritual mood. So this is something, it doesn't have any fixed time, but it's very important in our spiritual life. Then we have certain practices that are occasional practices, such as keeping holy company. Sri Ramakrishna talked about going into solitude from time to time. I'll get to all of these things, very important. And going on pilgrimage, going to a holy place, place conducive to meditation and contemplation. Now, before we go into detail with this list, I want to look at a section from the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna that really, to me, is one of the most important. Of course, the first meetings that M had with Sri Ramakrishna, we get almost everything there. But this is the conversation between Sri Ramakrishna and Ishan. That really, Sri Ramakrishna was at his best. He was really with this idea of no more floating on the surface. Now it's time to dive deep. So I want to go through this a little bit, this chapter advice to Ishan. But I want to give a little background. If we don't know anything else about this Ishan, and we only read this one chapter, we may not have a very high opinion of Ishan. We say, what is wrong with this guy? Sri Ramakrishna is telling him, why are you doing all of this ritualistic stuff and everything? Why doesn't he simply listen to him? It sounds like he's a little egotistical, a little stubborn, all of these things. But the opposite is true. Sri Ramakrishna wouldn't have spoken to him the way he did if he didn't have great love and respect for him. There's a section in the Great Master that talks about this Ishan. It says, seldom does one meet a devotee like Ishan, so kind and generous, with such faith in God. Narendra would visit him quite often and sing with his sweet voice, while one of Ishan's sons accompanied him on the tabla. Narendra once told us that Ishan's kindness was not less than that of Vidyasagar, who was considered to be the most generous and philanthropical person alive at that time. On many occasions, Swamiji himself saw Ishan give away his entire meal to beggars and practically go without food himself because there was no cooked food at home. Ishan practiced japa on a regular basis at Dakshineshwar from sunrise to sunset. So imagine. His steadfast devotion made him very dear to Sri Ramakrishna and one of his favorites. We remember that one evening, after finishing his japa, Ishan bowed down at Sri Ramakrishna's feet, and Sri Ramakrishna, in ecstasy, touched Ishan's head with his feet. When Sri Ramakrishna later regained normal consciousness, he told Ishan emphatically, O Brahman, dive deep, dive deep. So this whole section really is about this idea of diving deep. We read this, pages 611 to 617. It was October 11th, 1884, at Dakshineshwar. Sri Ramakrishna had left his room. He was going towards the Kali temple. He offered some flowers and waved at Chamar in front of his mother. So, of course, he was in some ecstatic mood. impossible for him to go there and do all of that without going into some type of mood like that. So he's full of this ecstatic devotion for the Divine Mother. And what does he see? He sees that Ishan with his kosho kushi and everything there doing this ritualistic worship. So that triggered this whole thing. So we'll see that he gives one blow after another blow to this Ishan. He really pummels him in this section. He says, how long must a man continue his sandhya? As long as he has not developed love for the lotus feet of God, as long as he does not shed tears and his hair does not stand on end when he repeats God's name. And then he spoke a little bit about love of God, removing the need for formal worship. This was one of Thakur's main teachings, that all of the preliminary things, they last until this spontaneous love bubbles up within the heart, then we're finished. Then we don't have to do it anymore. Then he talked about the need for exertion, for self-effort in spiritual life. You cannot achieve anything by moving at such a slow pace. You need stern renunciation. You seem to have no strength, no grit. You are as mushy as flattened rice soaked in milk. Be up and doing. Gird your loins. Okay, so this, another blow. Then he talks about renunciation and desires. You ask me why you don't feel stern renunciation. There is a reason for it. You have desires and tendencies within you. In our part of the country, I have seen peasants bringing water into their paddy fields. The fields have low ridges on all sides to prevent the water from leaking out, but these are made of mud and often have holes here and there. The peasants work themselves to death to bring the water, which, however, leaks out through the holes. Desires are the holes. You practice japa and austerity, no doubt, from morning till night. You practice japa and austerities, no doubt, but they all leak out through the holes of your desires. And then he talks about the nature of the mind. He says, the mind is dispersed. Part of it has gone to Dhaka, part to Delhi, another part to Kuch Bihar. The mind is to be gathered in. It must be concentrated on one object. If you want 16 annas worth of cloth, then you have to pay the merchant the full 16 annas. This is Swami Prabhavananda. He used to say that if you want God realization, there's a price. There's a price is your head. That means we have to, this ego has to go and we have to give everything. Whole life has to be given. So if you want 16 annas worth of cloth, then you have to pay the merchant the full 16 annas. Yoga is not possible if there is the slightest obstacle. If there is a tiny break in the telegraph wire, then the news cannot be transmitted. Then he talks about his bhakti yoga and karma yoga. You are no doubt in the world. What if you are? You must surrender the fruit of your action to God. You must not seek any result for yourself. But mark one thing. The desire for bhakti cannot be called a desire. You may desire bhakti and pray for it. Practice the tamas of bhakti and force your demand upon the Divine Mother. Then the final thing that he'll talk about has to do with karma yoga. And all of these things, we have to understand the context. This is somebody who has reached the end of his life. He was an elderly man and he had done so much his whole life. Arbitration and leadership, how trifling these are. He used to do these in the community. Charity and doing good to others, you have had enough of these. Those who are to devote themselves to such things belong to a different class. So he knew that the Ishan had this potential to really have some higher realization. Now the time is ripe for you to devote your mind to the lotus feet of God. Be mad with love of God. Let people know that Ishan has gone mad and cannot perform worldly duties anymore. Then people will no longer come to you for leadership and arbitration. Throw aside the kosha kushi and justify your name of Ishan, the all-renouncing Shiva. Now, what do we learn from all of this? First thing is that diving deep requires, first of all, a tremendous amount of vairagya. This vairagya, we sometimes say dispassion, sometimes say renunciation. It sounds a little bit negative, and it doesn't sound so romantic or so inspiring. But it's really the exact opposite. This vairagya is something that strikes one, that enters into someone, that overpowers someone. When this real vairagya comes, then it becomes impossible to withstand the force of that vairagya. So it's a very, very positive thing. There's a very tremendous power, strong sense of distaste for the world and distaste for the superficialities. And a tremendous desire to get the heart of things, to discard everything that is preventing us from understanding our real nature and having some higher type of realization. So it really is something which just makes everything else seem very trivial and not worth doing this when this real renunciation comes. And Thakur talked about this real renunciation. These are, as I say, these are for those who will give up everything. The householder with worldly duties has to try to practice these things in the mental sense, this mental type of renunciation, which is what he was saying to Ishan, because Ishan still was living in the world. Now, how do we achieve this? Is this something that can be cultivated, or we wait till it simply happens? There are certain things that we can do. One, which we may not expect, but one thing which Ramakrishna also talks about is meditate on death. One time he even says one should constantly think of death. Now, not in a morbid sense, but in the sense that this life is something very short, that we shouldn't waste it. We shouldn't get to the end of this life and feel that, well, what did I do? All the enjoyments, all of the goals, everything I had, what does it mean at this point? So constantly remember the transitory nature of this life and that it'll come to an end one day. Swamiji used to quote this verse. I don't know where it's from exactly, but it says something like when one practices meditation, when one calls on God, one should feel as if Yama has a hold of the tuft of hair on his head, is pulling him. And we sit for meditation. It's a nice type of meditation. Sit for meditation thinking that this is the last meditation we'll ever do. This will be the last day of our life. And see the difference in that intensity and that seriousness. We read the hymns like the Bhaja Govindam, and we see it's full of that type of vairagya, which comes from seeing how transitory this world is. Some of you know, when I was a little bit younger, I was also a little bit nutty. And I did funny things. When my very first trip to India, when I was in Benares, I hadn't read anything. I didn't know anything at all. But somehow I felt attracted to this idea. And I used to go to the Manikarnika Ghat and watch them burning the bodies. So one night I decided I'll spend the whole night there. And you watch one after another after another, and something comes over you. This vairagya comes, and you think, yes, so this is life. These people, who knows what type of life they had. One could be 100 years old, one could be 20 years old. But just like that, everything's gone, and what's left? A little bit of ash is left, nothing else is left. Dersya Chai, Holy Mother used to say that. Look at this body. It's just a few pounds of ashes. That's all that it is. And we're so attached to it. So this is a very good way to get rid of this attachment. But it shouldn't be a morbid type of thing. At least we should understand the whole point of it. Now, the vairagya, we know Thakur never spoke about it without speaking about anuraga, the other half of it. It's not enough to have distaste for the world. Many people are like that and they don't do anything. We have to have some longing for something higher. We have to have some tremendous desire for God realization, or to cast off this veil of Maya, have some direct experience of the self. So these two things go together. So how do we get this? This is anuraga. The easiest and best way is a holy company. And this holy company is anyone who wants to lead a spiritual life. We're all holy company that way. But as I say, if we really want to go deep, and this spiritual life, and dive deep and develop this vairagya, then this holy company has to be the company of somebody who really has renounced everything. We get a different type of feeling when we see someone who is not a care in the world, who doesn't possess anything. So this type of holy company will bring automatically at least some understanding that there's joy in vairagya and fearlessness. Everything else is fraught with fear. We have the Bhaitari Hari poem. Everything is fraught with fear. Vairagya alone is abhayam, is free from fear in that way. So when we see that, when we see the shining example of somebody who is above everything, beyond the fray of everything, then the world recedes away from us. We have the wonderful line from the Kandana that sampada tava shri pada bhavavos pada varyatai, that the blessed feet of Sri Ramakrishna are like a tremendous treasure for us. And when we see that, then this world appears to be a little mud puddle, that's all. We can get some pleasure out of it. We can we see the animals in these big mud puddles in the hot sun. They'll wallow in it and get cooled a little bit. But that's it. That's all. We won't be able to have that understanding unless we see someone who has transcended it and has a type of joy that comes from within that we can't even imagine. So that's why this holy company, both of these, for this vairagya and also for this anuraga, for this joy that comes. Now, what does it mean to keep holy company? There are two different points of view. And it's interesting that we get them from two of the direct disciples of Sri Ramakrishna. Some will say that, and most will say, that holy company doesn't simply mean that we're in the same room with the holy person. So how many people in Dakshineswar saw Sri Ramakrishna? How many of them lived with him day and night, the different priests in the temples and the workers there? Nothing. We don't see any change that way. So Gita says that we have to bow down, right? Paripratena, we have to pariprasnena, we have to ask questions, we have to serve. So we have to go approach with humility and have some shraddha, all of these things, then we'll get the full benefit of it. Now the other side, which is equally interesting, or if not more interesting, Mahapurush Maharaj. He was made a statement once that anyone who sees a divine incarnation will be liberated like that. So then somebody said, how can you say that, Maharaj? How many people saw Sri Ramakrishna, just as I was saying before, and nothing happened? And he got very angry. And he said, don't you know, even the dogs and cats in Kamarpukur who saw Sri Ramakrishna will be liberated. So that was his faith. We need both. We need that tremendous faith in the power of a holy person. And we also have to approach with humility, and we have to approach with this desire to catch some of that. We read this so often, Swamiji used to say, it's spiritual life. It's catching something. The burning fire is there. That fire has to light the fire within us also. And then we have to keep flaming. We have to keep fanning that fire. Keep that fire going. Then one of the best ways of going deep in spiritual life is solitude. And Sri Ramakrishna, he mentions that in his own way, part of the scolding, when he says, don't forget yourself because of what you hear from your flatterers. Flatterers gather around a worldly man. Vultures gather around the carcass of a cow. Now the point is, not just flatterers, anyone. That when we're in the presence of other people, we have a different view of ourselves. We see ourselves through the eyes of the other person. We objectify ourselves because we know how they see us. They see us as a physical presence. The longer we go in solitude without that type of experience, the more we start to see ourselves from inside out. We start to see ourselves as a pure conscious being. So this solitude, part of it, of course, is that we're free from all the botheration, that we don't have to deal with anything. We can focus on our spiritual practice. Part of it is that we can analyze where our shortcomings are, all of that. But psychologically, to me, this is the most interesting part, that we start to lose this feeling of being an embodied being, and we just feel ourselves to be the center from which the whole universe can be seen. I tell these things so often, I get tired of hearing myself say them. Maybe some of you haven't heard. I spent 1 year in one part of Calcutta when I had an opportunity to really practice this type of solitude. I knew people. It wasn't that I didn't see anyone at all, but I came up with this idea. I won't keep any mirror in the place where I stayed. I had these two little rooms, thinking that looking at ourselves in a mirror is something like having another person there looking at us. It's another way of objectifying ourselves. And we want to see ourselves as the subject. I want to see myself as this pure consciousness, so no mirror. And every few days I would go to the barber and get a shave or something like that. Sometimes I would go out, my face would be all smudged from the kerosene, you know, the stoves and things like that. I didn't even know it. But it really makes a difference that we really start to disidentify with this body. We start to understand the real nature of the self as pure consciousness. So it's a very wonderful thing. And in solitude, we get to practice silence. This is another great spiritual discipline. Because speech is a way of really letting the spiritual air out of ourselves. It's another way of objectifying ourselves. We want people to know who we are. We say things, of course, to communicate. But even every little communicator has a little bit of, you know, me in it. Little kids are always saying, look at me, right? We do the same thing in speech. We want people to know who we are, how kind we are, how nice we are, how intelligent we are. So there's always something about the way we say things and why we say it and when we say it. And those people who don't feel that need to speak are generally people who don't feel the need to have other people look at them and appreciate them. And so this practice of silence, very important, very freeing. These people who go on these long retreats, we think it'll be very horrible, very difficult. And it is for some people. But others, they feel a great amount of freedom. Freedom then comes, not having to respond. Why do we really want everyone to know what we're thinking all of the time? And this other idea, why do we want people to agree with us all the time? All of these things, they go back to this ego, right? And this false idea of who we are. So the solitude, this idea of practice of silence, all of these things are very, very helpful. The solitude, that's our one chance to really intensify. Otherwise, we're involved with so many other things. So when Thakur says it so many times, we should listen to him. It's one of the most common things that he says. Holy company solitude. Holy company solitude. Both of these. Very, very important. Now, this idea of our daily practice, I want to get back to that because this is very, very important, this idea of having a fixed time for everything. And again, it sounds like something that we're uselessly putting ourselves under some type of bondage. And it is something that the mind will reject, that we won't get any joy out of it, and that we'll give it up. Now, most of this is due to a very poor understanding of what we're trying to do. The whole point of a very fixed type of schedule is so we can go beyond it. But we have to have that in the beginning, and Sri Ramakrishna says that. What are we trying to do with our meditation and our prayer and our japa and all of these things? We're trying to increase our longing for God, the Vakulata. This is the main point of it. And we're trying to tire out our wings, right, so we can practice Sharanagati. We can take refuge in God. So we can't eliminate that. We have to keep that. But we also have to have some real incentive and some longing to do it. One of the most important things that Thakur says that we also don't think about too much is something he mentions to the Brahmos, mostly. They didn't care much for the Vaishnava things, his Radha Krishna business and everything. So Thakur said, well, that's fine. You don't have to accept this play between Radha and Krishna, whether they lived or didn't live, it doesn't matter. But accept that longing that Radha had to see Krishna. Now, how do we have that type of longing ourselves? What would she do? She would get up in the middle of the night. Get up in the middle of the night, everyone else is sleeping. She would slip out and she would go and they would actually meet face to face. We have to feel somehow that we get up early in the morning, everyone is sleeping, everything is quiet. We're on our way to meet Thakur. This is our opportunity. He's waiting for us. He spent the night going up on the roof calling, oh, where are you? Where are you, my children? Please come. So we have to feel that in our meditation, we're making that trip. We're traveling to Dakshineswar. We're going to Jaranabati. We're going to Vrindavan. We're going to Benares, whatever our spiritual ideal is. And we'll be sitting face to face with the Lord, dwelling within the heart. If our meditation is just a mental exercise, there won't be much incentive to do it. If we feel that, yes, the Lord is waiting for us, we're sleeping, he's waiting for us, then we'll get up. We'll get up early in the morning and we'll go sit in the shrine and we'll enter Thakur's room and we'll sit face to face with Thakur. Then we'll find some joy. Then we'll find that we're longing to do our spiritual practice. If we miss it, we'll feel miserable. So this really is a very important way to keep that fire burning. Keep that fire burning that we will have that direct experience, direct communion with God dwelling within ourselves that will block out everything else. We'll sit quietly and we'll do it early in the morning when there's no one else to bother us, when everything is quiet, other people are sleeping. Now, what about this question of time? I think this idea of getting up early is something very important. But how long should we sit for meditation? We often hear that it's not the amount of time we spend in spiritual practice, but how well we're concentrated, the intensity. It's half true. The other half of the truth is that there's no way to do things very quickly that way. There's no substitute for time. First of all, it's a sign of our priorities. If we're willing to put in that extra time, taking it away from other things that we might do, then it's a clear sign to us that this is a very high priority for us, that this is one of the most important things that we have, the most important thing that we have. So this question of time is very important, how long we spend in meditation and japa. We know that Holy Mother had her standard answer whenever she was told by her disciples, Mother, why don't I see Thakur? Why don't I make progress in spiritual life? They would come and they would ask her all of these questions. And she would say, my child, how much japa do you do? He said, you repeat the name 20,000 times. You know, and then let me know, 20,000 times, we're talking about hours on end. It's not a joke to do it, something like that. So this amount of time that we spend in meditation is something very important. I have this theory that most of the reason why we don't really achieve much in meditation is that we get up too soon. That, at least for me, there's a period where the mind has to run around, and it may be a long period of time. And it may be that a good meditation means that the last 5 minutes are good. And if we get up before that, we never have it. Not so much that if it's not a good meditation in the beginning, then forget it. We're wasting our time. That we have to go through that period where the mind is wandering here and there. And then it may settle down a little bit towards the end. And otherwise, we won't get it. And even what we may call a bad meditation, if day after day, week after week, year after year, we're willing to put in the time without really getting that great joy from meditation, something grows within us. The Swami Swanandi used to say that the main fruit of meditation is devotion. It's not that the mind develops this quality to become perfectly still. That's a very rare thing. But even the type of meditation where it's struggling year after year after year, there's a tremendous result that comes from that. At the end of that whole period, we think, yes, I must have some type of devotion to keep doing. We feel something, some transformation takes place. This is why I keep going back to the bird on the mast. It's not that flying in one direction, it'll find land. It doesn't do that. But it comes back, and at the end of all of this struggle, it attains peace. The bird says, yes, wherever the ship will take me, then I'll be happy. I'll take refuge with the ship itself. So this putting in time and meditation and prayer and japa, all of these things are extremely important. Then how often should we sit for meditation, prayer, whatever our spiritual routine is? Generally, we hear twice a day is is best. If we can do more, but it's not practical for most people. If we can do more, then it's even better. Generally, sunrise and sunset, the two sandhya periods. There's supposed to be some type of calm in nature at that time. I always think that if we begin meditation when it's dark out and we finish when it's light, then we feel some transformation. And again, if we start when it's light out and finish when it's dark, that this nature has changed, and inside something is changing within us. So these are considered very important times. Noon, because it's also kind of sandhya period, and sometimes they say midnight. Now, I won't do that because a little too much, but there's some who do that. If you go to Belermat, of course, you can't do it, but if you go at midnight and wander around and go to the backs of some of these, the Holy Mother's temple, Swamiji's temple, you'll see one or two monks who are sitting there without letting anyone know. They'll get up in the middle of the night, they'll sit for meditation, they'll go back. People will think, Thakur says, people will think they didn't sleep well at night, they're tired in the morning, this and that. But there's something happens when people have that type of dedication and devotion and longing for God, that they'll get up in dead of night and do it. So all of these things are helpful. The reason why having multiple times for our spiritual practice is important is because we're giving a good big spin to this spiritual wheel in the morning, and we get involved with the world and it slows down. If we can give it another spin before it stops, that inertia that has to be overcome, if we don't have to overcome that, we can do even small meditations. This Swami Parameshananda, he used to say that every once in a while in the middle of the day, close your eyes for 5 minutes. Try to get back into that meditative state like that. So we keep it moving. We try to keep that meditative state in the background of the mind the whole time. Repeat this mantra throughout the day as far as possible. And then when we sit for meditation after that, the mind very easily will slip back into that meditative state. And the ideal, of course, is for that to be the default state where the mind is meditative. And then when it has to deal with the world, it's a little bit jarred, it's a little bit out of sync, and we can't wait to get back to what seems to be the real default, the real natural state of ourselves. Then we know that we're on the right path. So really what we have to do, this idea of intensity, we have to gradually increase these things. And one thing I find is that, you know, we're striving very hard for love of God and for love of the spiritual experiences and things like that. We have to develop love for spiritual practice and realize the joy that there is in spiritual practice. Otherwise, it's a chore. And it won't be helpful for us, and we'll give it up eventually. So this gradually increasing, this gradually spending more time in spiritual practice, very helpful thing. Depends on stage of life also. Remember Ishan, he really was in that retired state. He didn't have to do anything. It was very easy for him to give up all of these other things. This is why when we hear about this karma yoga, that he tells him, give up all of these things. You've done enough of good deeds and everything. He won't say that to others. He'll say, you're earning money, you have to use your money in a good way. He was never against those things. But those who reach that point where they're ready to give up everything and dive deep, they have to do that. Now, I just want to mention a few more things. Spiritual reading. This is, for many of us, the best holy company because we don't have an opportunity to have holy company all the time. There are all different types. What is really the best in this particular context is inspirational types of things. We read about the direct disciples. I mentioned the Bharanagar period, that intense renunciation that they had. Of course, the best of all is reading the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna, for me, at least. And the companion to that is pilgrimage, to actually go to all of these places, to go to Dakshineswar. M was the greatest proponent of that. Whoever came to him, he would say, have you been to Dakshineswar? And he said, you go there. And he would go with them sometimes. And he would point out, this is where Thakur did this, he did that, he worshipped Holy Mother here, Shodashi Puja, under the bell tree. He did his tantric sadhana, all of that. He said you etch these things into your mind, into your heart. When you sit for meditation, you can feel that you're recreating that scene. You'll feel that Thakur is actually there. That is, you can be sitting in the room while he's worshiping Holy Mother. You can be sitting there while he's up dancing and singing and clapping in front of all the pictures and all of that. So these two things together. I was very fortunate that I went to Dakshineswar before I read the gospel. So when I read it for the first time, I knew when it meant he's facing north. I could picture where the room was and all of those things. So to me, this idea of pilgrimage is very important. And last thing is worship. Worship, or I'm going to take it back, not the last thing. Let me just, I don't want to forget about prayer, because really, very few of us are very good at meditation, but everyone can pray. And Thakur emphasized that so much, prayer, with tears in the eyes. The tears of the eyes will wash away the dirt of the heart. He said, if you can weep for God for 24 hours, you can have God realization. Whenever he heard that any of the disciples had wept for God, he was so happy. So this power of prayer is something very, very tremendous. Now, finally, let me talk about worship, because this idea of a little bit slightly formal worship, at least to the extent where we burn some incense, we offer some flowers, maybe we offer some food, something like that. It's a way to keep the thought of God or our chosen ideal in the mind throughout the day, because we don't simply offer flowers. We'll have a garden, right? We'll water the garden. Every time we're watering it, we're thinking, yeah, these are flowers that will be offered. We go shopping. And we think, what can I buy for Thakur? Well, this will be part of the offering that's done in the morning. So we see even here, well, what will be the next cloth that we'll put on Thakur? All of these things. The mind gets absorbed in all of that. That becomes the underlying reality for us. So all of these things are extremely important. The slight element of madness to all of them, and the irrationality with grown people putting a dress on a marble statue. But the results are tremendous. And this is the most important thing. This little bit of madness is what we need to be able to dive deep. And unless we dive deep, we won't go get those gems that are lying at the bottom of the ocean. And where is that ocean? That ocean is within our very own heart. So these are just some of the ideas that we find, some of the teachings that we find from Sri Ramakrishna about this wonderful practice of diving deep, because he wanted everyone to have some experience of the divine, and it's possible for all of us because that divinity rests within us. It's our very nature. It's that ocean. We're just a little wave on that whole ocean of divinity which resides within ourselves. So let us sit quietly for a few minutes. Asado ma sadhamaya tamaso ma dhotirvamaya murityurma maritam nugamaya aviravirmayethi rudrayate dakshanam mukham tenamam pahi nityam. Om shanti 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 harihi om tatsat. Lead us from the unreal to the real. Lead us from darkness to light. Lead us from death to immortality. Light us through and through, O Lord, and protect us evermore with thy compassionate face. Om peace, peace, peace be with you.